just recently in Pennsylvania, a 14-year-old girl in Pennsylvania wrote to the advice columnist Dear Abby after finding out that she was conceived with donor sperm. In just a few sentences, she identified some of the enormous identity issues that confront donor-conceived young people and that I argue are now a challenge to our society. She wrote, "It scares me to think I may have brothers or sisters out there and that he, the sperm donor, may not care that I exist. This young teenager, struggling alone, clearly, with feelings of abandonment and grief and confusion, poignantly challenged the current legal and social position on this issue. She said, I don't understand why it's legal to just donate when a child may be born." In your own country, in Canada, there are compelling voices that are arising around this topic. Barry Stevens, a filmmaker, made a documentary in 2001 called Offspring. He lives in Toronto. It's about his experience and that of others seeking his biological father, who was a sperm donor, seeking half-siblings. He speaks often in the media. There are others as well, and we're honored today to have Olivia Pratton, who's here, who's spoken often in the media about her experience and who will be sharing some of her story and her perspective after my talk and before the response. In addition, we have Diane Allen here today, and she was the person who made the last comment at the Birthed Earth talk. She's there in the back of the room. Can you just raise your hand just so people... And I encourage you to get to know her. She runs the Infertility Network in Toronto, which she referred to as a small charity, small perhaps only on a line item budget, but she's doing great things. I have been on her message board email kind of service for about a year and a half, and she is extremely well informed on what's going on in this cluster of issues, not just in Canada, but around the world, and is really in some ways leading a single-handed charge and to advocate for the child's point of view in a way that is very sensitive to the parents and especially the mother's point of view. And she works with these mothers who struggle with infertility on a daily basis. She understands where they're coming from, but she's also listening to the children and young people as well who are conceived from these technologies. And she's a terrific resource that you have right here in Toronto. There are others speaking out in this country as well. And as I emphasized, they don't speak with one voice, and they come particularly at some questions like the issue of same-sex marriage from a variety of positions. So, for instance, if they have some critiques of the practice of donor conception, one can't presume where they fall on the same-sex marriage issue. I think they fall in a range of positions. So from a social scientific point of view, what do we know about children's experiences when they do not grow up with their own mother and father? In many areas, we know a great deal. In some, we need to learn more. Today, increasing numbers of people are realizing that marriage has important benefits for children. What many do not know is that there is something about the marriage of a child's own mother and father, as opposed to, for instance, a remarriage, that on average brings these benefits. On many important indicators of child well-being, such as teen pregnancy, educational failure, delinquency, child abuse, children raised in step families look more like children of single parents than children raised by their own married mother and father. Some who advocate for legalized same-sex marriage say that it will be good for children because children will now have two parents. But the stepfamily data suggests it may not be that simple. We don't know how much the poorer outcomes in stepfamilies are due to the history of dissolution or other unique problems facing stepfamilies, or how much is due to the child being raised in a home with a non-biologically related stepparent. With regard to same-sex parenting, the existing research is very small and limited because same-sex couples are raising children, comprise a very small part of the population, and are only recently becoming more visible. And a big problem with the current literature is that most of it compares single lesbian mothers with single heterosexual mothers. In other words, it compares children in one kind of fatherless family with children in another kind of fatherless family. So when advocates for same-sex marriage say the research is out there and it shows there are no differences, the research largely shows there's no differences in one kind of fatherless family versus another. But we don't know very well yet how children raised by same-sex parents fare in long-term outcomes compared to those raised by their own mother and father. Again, in Canada, you have a tremendous resource in the Halpern case that I believe legalized same-sex marriage in Ontario some years back. Stephen Nock, a University of Virginia sociologist, leading family scholar in the United States, not a conservative, surveyed, as a friend of the court brief, all the existing research at that time in 2001 on same-sex parenting and outcomes for children. And he found, by his estimation, that the studies were flawed by poor design. They were small. They tended to rely on mothers' reports of their child well-being rather than objective measures of the children's well-being, and they compare children in one kind of fatherless family with children from another. So we just don't know yet what the outcomes are for children in raised by same-sex parents, which means at the very least we should be cautious, I think, about instituting major changes in family law. We have far more to learn, but evidence and sensitive observations of children's lives strongly suggest the importance to children of at least recognizing their need to be raised whenever possible by their own mother and father, with adoption as a critical pro-child backup plan, and the importance of recognizing the absence of their mother or father as a serious loss for a child. I have friends and colleagues who are gay and lesbian, and I certainly understand the desire for a child. My question, if someone was to ask me, so, you know, Elizabeth, you do all this writing and all this stuff, go on radio and talk about this. I want to have a child with my partner. I mean, what do you think? And I guess my main question would be, for instance, gay men, two gay men, lovely people who want to have a baby and use a surrogate to have a baby. My question would to them, if they wanted to hear what I thought, would be, if the child feels the loss of their mother, will they be allowed to grieve? And that would be my thought. I'm not saying the child will feel the loss of a mother, but if they do, and personally I think they will, if they do, will they be allowed to grieve, or will their grief for their absent mother be too painful for their parents to tolerate? That's at the heart of my concern. My other concern about legalizing same-sex marriage is that it sends a powerful cultural message to the vast majority of people who are heterosexuals that when they have a child, it doesn't really matter if they stick around for the child. After all, children don't necessarily need their own mom and dad. They just need two loving parents. And so it sends a powerful message to our current generation, and especially our next generation, that you don't necessarily have to do all the hard things possible to stick together for your child's sake when you have a child. You just have to make sure there's at least two, maybe one if they're really terrific, or maybe more, three or more. You just have to make sure that the child has parents, but not necessarily their own mom and dad. So it really edits mothers and fathers out of our law. It's doing that already. It edits mothers and fathers out of our cultural dialogue. And when we can no longer say that mothers or fathers are important, how can we convince the next generation to do the hard things necessary to be good mothers and fathers to the children that they have? So the revolution in parenthood, I'm talking about what's already happening right now. What's next? What's just around the corner? Around the world, the revolution in parenthood is contributing to further deep uncertainties in the meaning of motherhood and fatherhood. By far the most striking and potentially far-reaching development, one already being witnessed in numerous courts, is the increasing recognition of psychological parenthood, or de facto parental status. And again, forgive me, I know more about what's going on in the U.S. here, and if some of you know about this issue in Canada, I hope that you'll share that in the discussion. In the United States, at least 10 states now allow someone with no biological or adoptive relationship to a child and no marital relationship to a child's mother or father to be assigned parental rights and responsibilities as a psychological or de facto parent. To determine retrospectively whether an adult was a parent in a child's life, the courts examine indications such as whether the adult lived in the same household with the child, was encouraged to act as a parent by the child's existing parent, had acted like a parent without expecting financial compensation, so that rules out nannies and babysitters, and had spent enough time with the child for the child to have bonded with him or her. In many of these cases, the petitions are brought by ex-partners who charge that the child's existing parent is denying them rights to the child. In other cases, the child's existing parent charges that the ex-partner is now shirking parental responsibilities. These cases typically concern, at the moment, same-sex partners, but they also have serious, as yet unknown, implications for the many heterosexuals who are or have been a child's step-parent or a parent's live-in partner. I mean, just consider the prospect that if you live with someone who has a child and you move out after a year, based on these indications, a court could determine that you are a legal parent of the child of your ex-live-in partner and have financial obligations to that child until they're age 18. I think that alone would just get the attention of a lot of people who may not consider themselves particularly conservative or concerned about family change today. It's an extraordinary instance of the courts reaching into private decisions that adults are making without on their own, and it's framed in the best interest of the child, and I understand the intentions there, that when people act like parents to children, they shouldn't be allowed to just disappear. But unfortunately, when we start entering in and trying to legally tinker with relationships between adults and with children to whom they are not related, we can create more problems than we resolve. And one of the things that these cases involving psychological or de facto parenthood do is contribute to further deep uncertainties about who children's parents are. In the hard sciences as well, we're seeing extraordinary challenges to the two-parent mother-father model of parenthood. Right now, scientific research around the world with the DNA in eggs and sperm is raising the possibility that children could be born from one genetic parent, also known as cloning, two same-sex parents, or three parents. Headlines recently announced research at leading universities in Britain and New Zealand that could enable same-sex couples or single people to procreate. All of these cases are documented in the footnotes of my report, and as well in the footnotes I talk about some of the headlines that came out when researchers in Australia and Britain announced that they were pursuing research that could lead to same-sex couples procreating, being able to procreate. Around the world, headlines like doing away with donors, new hope for gay and lesbian couples, and on some of the gay and lesbian parenting websites, just embracing the research with great fanfare. And one doctor who's not involved in the research said, well, it can be really hard for the partner of someone in a same-sex relationship who's not the biological parent. It can be really hard for that person. So this new research really helps to, you know, like hold out the hope that someday we can, you know, help with those self-esteem issues of these adults who are not able to be the biological parent of the child while their partner is the biological parent. That's all well and good, but all you have to do is look at the research. Japanese scientists have already created a mouse with two mothers and no father. This was reported in National Geographic. In order to do so, they implanted 370 embryos, of which 10 survived to birth and only one survived past birth. My question would be, why on earth would we try this with human embryos and infants in order to satisfy the parenting needs of some adults? British scientists have been granted permission recently to create a human embryo with three genetic parents. And last year, a team in Scotland tricked an egg into dividing and creating an embryo without a genetic father. Meanwhile, the stem cell research field is growing ever closer to the fertility industry, something that I think a lot of people don't realize. We think of stem cell research debates as being over here and stuff about fertility, infertility debates being over here. They're actually getting closer and closer together. As scientists strike bargains with doctors to secure eggs needed for therapeutic cloning from women undergoing fertility treatments, the thing that stem cell researchers and fertility doctors have in common is they both need the eggs. Scientists in Britain were just given permission by the state regulatory authority there to allow them to help pay for IVF treatments for women undergoing treatment for infertility if the woman will give them some of her eggs. Further, these techniques, stem cell research field and the fertility industry are growing ever closer as cloning techniques are perfected in the stem cell research field and hold the prospect of being used sooner or later in the reproductive technology field. Some people say, don't be crazy, cloning, nobody's ever going to do that. Last year at a public conference in Britain, James Watson, who with Francis Crick discovered the structure of DNA, and Robert Edwards, the father of IVF treatment, so these are two guys who are not quacks and they're not flakes, two major powerhouse scientists, at a public conference in Britain last year, they both called for reproductive cloning to be offered to available to couples who have exhausted all other options. And they said in there that, you know, if we stand back and say this can't be done, we're not helping our patients. In the hard sciences, too, the two-person mother-father model of parenthood is facing serious challenges, and all of it's happening right now, and we have virtually no public debate. New developments in the marriage debate are also posing challenges. Whatever one's feeling about the legalization of same-sex marriage, and however emphatically most advocates of same-sex marriage say they do not support group marriage, recent events make clear that successes in the same-sex marriage movement have emboldened others who wish to borrow the language of civil rights to break open the two-person understanding of marriage and, with it, parenthood. These efforts are emerging from at least two surprising directions. The polyamorists, those who practice polyamory, are perhaps the newest and most unfamiliar players on the scene. Polyamory means many loves, as opposed to polygamy, which means many marriages. Polyamory involves relationships with three or more people, any two of whom may or may not be married to one another. Polyamorous variously describe themselves as heterosexual, homosexual, bisexual, or just plain poly, in contrast to polygamists, who are generally heterosexual. Advocates for polyamory often explicitly mimic the language used by, and I think the very legitimate language used by, supporters of gay, lesbian, bisexual people. The polyamory people, who I don't think are very legitimate, say they must keep their many loves in the closet, that they cannot risk revealing their personal lives for fear of losing their jobs or custody of their children, that to reveal their inner poly nature is coming out of the closet, that being poly is just who they are. For these folks, if two parents are good for children, then three or more parents spread among one or more households and sharing a sexual relationship with one another is even better. Oh, thanks. The topic of polyamory is emerging at the cutting edge of family law and advocacy. It's not just something that practiced by a few old hippies in San Francisco. Major University of Chicago Law School professor there, Elizabeth Emmons, wrote a law paper published in the NYU Law Review advocating legal recognition of polyamorous relationships. Among religious organizations, the Unitarian Universalists for Polyamorous Awareness hope to make theirs the first to recognize and bless polyamorous relationships. They're not an official organization of the UU Church. At the same time, they have not been disowned by the UU Church either. There is actually controversy among the UUs about whether to welcome these people in their midst or not. And for now, they're being welcomed. If you read the message boards of parents who practice polyamory and how they understand it to integrate with their parenting, however, it is, I think, shocking and sad. I include some of those quotes in this report. One young woman who's in a polyamorous relationship, she and her boyfriend with another couple, and she's offended by her best friend's lack of compassion and understanding for this relationship, and she says, "My best friend thinks that we are damaging our partner's couple's six-year-old daughter by not being completely secretive about this relationship." It's not even that the fact that they're doing it, but they're supposed to keep it a secret, is what she thinks her friend is saying. By being open and honest about this, that we're damaging their six-year-old daughter. You know, another one who's in a polyamorous relationship and she's about to have a baby says she's a little worried about how this is all going to work out. And another one who's been there says, "Well, being poly and having a baby, it's not a cakewalk." And she says, "The first 6 months are extremely hard. Sometimes, you know, your other significant other, you have to cancel a date at the very last minute because the baby's sick or something. Sometimes, you know, he comes over with you and your husband with, you know, but if everyone's patient, you can get through it." And you're just thinking, I mean, what planet are these people on? You know, if you've had a baby, the first 6 months are hard. You don't even have time to have sex with your husband when you're married to one man when you have an infant. How you like maintain these things and still, you know, take care of your child is beyond me, certainly. Polygamy, of course, is much more familiar. It's currently criminalized in most of the West. It's been around since biblical times and long before. But its criminal status could change. It was remarkable. The new polygamy series on HBO that debuted this spring, Big Love, spawned surprisingly positive coverage of polygamy in the U.S. media, including sympathetic television interviews with polygamous families, a spate of news stories about these families, and the opinion of polygamy activists that theirs is the next civil rights battle. And even a New York Times columnist who argued, "If polygamy is the strongest argument against same-sex marriage, then let the wedding bells ring." And in a development that shocked many Canadians, two government studies released last winter by your Justice Department recommended the decriminalization of polygamy. In the U.S. and Canada, a number of legal scholars are arguing, as one columnist summarized, that the abuses of polygamy flourish amidst the isolation, stigma, and secrecy spawned by criminalization. In other words, polygamy per se is not the problem, only bad polygamy. If we can just legalize it and clean it up a little bit, that'll take care of the problem. But still, you might ask, okay, so we have some polygamists over there in Utah or wherever, and we have the polyamorous in Berkeley and some universities or whatever. Why would, I mean, how many people are these, are they really, and what would be the likelihood of them having their way? I think the root would be this: proposals for children to have three or more legal parents. It's been proposed by expert commissions in Australia and New Zealand that children be allowed to have three legal parents, a case now pending in Ontario where three people are seeking all to be legal parents of a child. If any of these initiatives or cases, or if this idea wins, you will hear the argument, why should children with three legal parents be denied the same rights and protections as those with only two parents? Once you have multiple legal parents for a child, you have the strongest civil rights on behalf of children argument for group marriage, the strongest argument you'll need. And so I think that would be the likely route. Will it happen today or tomorrow? I don't think so. But it's been surprising how many of these kind of supposedly slippery slope arguments have already occurred. Many of us who were sort of raising the red flag thought it would be 10, 20 years before we would like edit mothers and fathers out of family law or something. And we did that in about 5 minutes in some nations that have legalized same-sex marriage. So it's hard to say how long it will be. So what do we do now? You already know where I stand on same-sex marriage. Regard to these other cluster of issues, given that in some ways the genie is already out of the bottle, in some areas it's not entirely clear what actions the state and social leaders should take in the near future. For instance, with regard to reproductive technology, some nations have moved to ban the practice of anonymous donation of sperm and eggs. I think this is definitely a positive development for children. After all, you can make a very strong argument that children have a right and need to know their origins. Yet greater acceptance of the idea that donor-conceived children have a right to know their origins is also leading to the idea that these children should have some kind of a possibility for some kind of relationship with their sperm or egg donor and not just a file of information, or even that the donor should have some kind of legal parental status in the child's life, leading to scenarios in which a child could have three or more legal parents. So what might the future hold for children with three or more legal parents? We have no idea, but we have serious reason, I think, for concern. Or in another example, after Britain passed a law banning donor anonymity last year, there was a purported drastic drop in the number of men willing to donate sperm. However, individuals and couples in that nation who wish to conceive now have even greater incentive to go abroad to nations and regions that have less regulation, such as Spain, India, Eastern Europe, or elsewhere. You get your eggs from Eastern Europe, you get your wombs in India. Numerous news articles about European couples increasingly using surrogate mothers in India. Reproductive technology is less regulated in Spain. People go there as well. So going to these places to procure their sperm or eggs or surrogate wombs, making it even less likely that their child will ever be able to trace their origins or form a relationship with a distant and often impoverished donor abroad. And the power issues and exploitation of women going on right now. It's not just that women have the potential to be exploited in this egg donor surrogacy business. They already are being exploited. College women perceive $5,000 to be a lot of money. It's not a lot of money for the risk they undertake to donate eggs. And women abroad who are poor do this for the money. And they're taking on extraordinary risks, and their children will never know who their mothers are. So the exploitation is happening now. Again, how will these developments affect children? At the moment, we don't know for sure. We can't report statistics and data, but we certainly have serious and immediate cause for concern. For reasons like these, my report does not end with the usual list of policy recommendations. Rather, instead, it issues a call to citizens in the U.S. and Canada and around the world. And the call is for all of us to participate in urgently needed conversation and research about the revolution in parenthood and the needs of children. To provide time and space for this conversation and for research, this report calls for a moratorium or timeout lasting 5 years. Until we better understand and prioritize the needs of children, no legislatures, courts, or commissions should press forward with recommendations or changes that broadly undermine the normative importance of mothers and fathers in the lives of children, nor should they support intentionally denying unborn children knowledge of and a relationship with their own mother and father. Rather, they should concentrate their energies on rigorous inquiry and active debate about the needs of children and the roles of mothers and fathers in their lives. Okay. The facts are this: unless and until same-sex procreation or three-person reproduction becomes a reality, children will always arise from the union of a man and a woman. All children have, as the French feminist philosopher Sylviane Agacinski calls it, a double origin, that of a mother and a father, an origin we cannot deny and the children certainly cannot ignore because they see it every time they look in the mirror. When we change the mother-father dimension of marriage or the two-person understanding of marriage, we also change understandings of parenthood in ways that dramatically impact the future for children. Do fathers and mothers matter to children? Is there anything special, anything worth supporting about the two-parent mother-father model, or was that just kind of a passing idea? These are the questions on the table. Let's not experiment on a new generation of children and wait for the results to come in 20 years from now. That's what we did with the children of divorce. The time to take on these questions is now. Thanks.